All right, it's November 22nd, 2009. This is Scott Woods from rockcritics.com, talking once again to Bob Dobbs in Maui. How you doing, Bob?
Great. I'm enjoying what we've done so far. It's bringing out a lot of stuff for me. So I thank you for doing that.
No worries. It's sounding great. This is our third chat, and I wanted to just start this one by going to throw a short quote back at you. I was able to go through some of our discussion, not quite as in-depth as I want to. I'm still going to go through it all again and try and pull some quotes and whatnot. But one thing you did say which interested me was this. You said, and you're talking about Richard Meltzer, obviously. That's basically what we spent all of the last chat talking about. So you said, music is where you assert your private identity, and yet it's a flow. So there's Meltzer celebrating the flow and not too much on the value of any particular experience, just looking for something that approximates it. So I agree with that thought. I think that's exactly kind of what Meltzer is doing in the aesthetics of rock. He's not really saying throughout the book, you know, these records I'm writing about, this one is good, this one sucks, and that kind of thing. He's just kind of throwing them all into the pot and, you know, kind of getting high off the fumes of the whole thing. So I know McLuhan is often quoted, I think you've quoted him often, to the effect that, you know, it's just, I don't know if it's invalid is the right word, or it's puny to profess to have a point of view. But that is kind of a breach, in a way, against what is thought of as the traditional role of the critic, which is to give your opinion and to give your opinion forcefully. So, as usual, I don't really know where I'm exactly going with this quote, but just maybe go into that a little bit. I like that idea you expressed about Meltzer, with where he's not, you know, expressing too much about the value of any particular experience. You almost sort of said it as a throwaway line, but it really kind of jumped out at me.
Yeah, his concern is rock music, you know, by 65, and he wants to write about it. So he's fulfilling McLuhan's prediction that music will become a private concern. It's not the particular songs, although, you know, some are better than the others, but it's him focusing on it, and he may have been the first to be obsessive about it and to put in significant concepts to show the level of concern he had about it.
Right.
You know, he was very concerned, and it wasn't a point of view. He was, quote, obsessed with translating the meanings he got from the rock experience, rock and roll rock experience. So, and it was a private concern, and he didn't. That's why he said, "Well, how's this relevant to anybody else? I'll write about it if they'll print it, but I don't really expect anybody to take it too seriously." He was sort of aware it was just a private interest, but he was determined to think through the terms he got from college, the philosophy in that, and his experience with the art world. Think through what he was concerned about and see it translate in rock. So it illustrated a private concern more than a point of view. Now, the second point, a critic is supposed to have a point of view. Could you say what Robert Kresko's point of view is after 40 years? Could you say Marcus's point of view? You probably haven't read all the shifts and opinions about all the music and things they've commented on.
Right.
Maybe Marcus's Lipstick Traces gives a point of view. He celebrates, quote, the anarchic or something, or the temporary autonomous zone. What would one? Maybe the only point of view is, I think this is as important. This music I consume, pop music, is as important as your classical or jazz or symphony. You know what I mean? That might be the only thing they represent as a point of view, that I'm going to stay in this world and consume it and get value out of it.
Yeah, well, certainly they can't. I mean, yeah, the way you put it, I can't sort of suggest that any of them have a fixed point of view. Absolutely.
Right.
They're writing maybe from the point of view of where they are in that particular time and place, and then, you know, it might.
But they're acting out having a point of view, which is what the consumer of the Western consumer of rock has a private concern about music. So they want a private response to it, and that's the role of the rock critic. Not that what the critic says, but give a private response. Be privately concerned about it, and then the consumer can bounce off their concern. So it's more about hoiking up the private consumption of music as a private concern, as a way, an antidote to the tribal, corporate, multimedia role, you are forced to act in the global theater, which is very alienating to the individualist mind of the West. The hive mind is a threat. And so they hoik up, the critics and the consumers of music hoik up the individual genius or the individual spark. And that's really the value system that's represented by entertainment, by Hollywood.
Okay. Well, that if I'm interpreting you correctly, that's almost, that's kind of a conversation even within rock criticism itself, in that, you know, most people who write rock criticism, especially younger critics who are just, you know, kind of trying to find their voice and find their footing in the genre and all that, they inevitably kind of reach a moment where they realize that, you know, they're either going to have to sort of write as they think the magazine would have them write, or write as themselves. And if they write as themselves, you know, they ain't going to have a career probably in the normal sense of having a career of some sort. Like, is that the same sort of thing? Like,
yeah,
they have to take on the corporate voice in a way, or so long. And I mean, that's my situation. That's most of the people who, you know, who I'm friends with, who've been rock critics at various times or another. It's like, most of us kind of didn't really last, because you can't do what Meltzer does today. Even if you bypass the fact that, okay, well, most people just wouldn't have the time to try and, you know, parse those sentences. Even if you wrote in a much more sort of direct, straightforward style, you almost can't bring that much of yourself. Maybe, I don't know if that's what you call a private concern, but you can't bring that into, you know, Rolling Stone magazine or something like that. You can start your own fanzine or your own blog, and that's, you know, kind of what's happened.
Yeah, the McLuhan said, I think it's in Take Today, that he talks about, I think he quotes the Jan Wenner interview, which became a book called The Lennon Interview, about 1971. The one where Lennon says he'd rather have been Frank Zappa than a Beatle. McLuhan just says John Lennon has a tribal role, a corporate tribal electric role. That's what he was with the Beatles. And he tried to retrieve a private identity in relation to that, and went through all this angst. And couldn't retrieve it, or didn't know how to retrieve it. So what happens is that kids, who McLuhan called vegetables, take them a long time to grow, let them grow. These vegetables, these little consumer amoeba, what Zappa would call them, they're just growing up, 10, 15, 20, 18, you know, or probably younger. But they are looking for something to reflect their private identity as it's being reinforced. They get to high school and they got to get a job, so they have to figure out what they're going to major in and stuff like that. Now, this is back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So they're growing and developing a tribal identity. I mean, a private identity. But they have no awareness of how corporate and discarnate the image, the landscape they're trying to find a private identity within is. There's no private identity possible. Someone mentioned, I don't know who it was, the shock that kids got in the 60s is they'd have some favorite guy like Dylan or somebody. They'd go to the concert in the bigger cities and be shocked that there were 10,000 others who had the same obsession with you, who thought Dylan was speaking to you.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have the young mind, doesn't understand, can't perceive the ramification of the discarnate state, and doesn't know that the private identity they're trying to create through their celebrity roles or role models is nowhere like the private identity a teenager in the 19th century would go through. The process that, well, they didn't have the term teenager, they called them adolescents. They were meant to be seen and not heard. A whole different process of getting a private identity. But now you have the discarnate state in the 60s and 70s, so they're trying to get a private identity. So the rock critic comes in, and he, like Meltzer, is, say it this way. So the kids, when I say they're trying to find a private identity in the corporate role models that the entertainment state offers, that is looking for a private concern. You know, they're concerned about themselves, looking for a mirror. So the rock critic can come in, been to a lot of concerts, a little more savvy than the unwitting suburban consumer of rock, and he tries to be detached, he or she tries to be detached about it, but in the end, and so they might get a gig for a while, having a particular personal stance on their private concern of music that it, that reflects back to the consumer who's reading those reviews. But eventually they will wake up and realize that they are participating in what I call the Android meme. It is so much bigger than what they are, and in the end they are only providing a corporate role. What the corporate role they're providing is I will pretend I have a private point of view, and the kids who need a private point of view will be attracted to my style or my stance, my attitude. That is, in other words, you're putting on the whole Gutenberg galaxy of private identity. Kids now do that, and rock critics do that, or did that, and they miss, but they eventually become aware of, that they're just a, quote, cog in the machine, that they're actually creating the hologram of a private concern about music, so the young kids think music is something for their private concern. And most of the, you know, when bands, when guys get into bands and then they start touring, they realize what a grind it all is. They say, geez, we're just a machine. What is this? And then they freak out. They get into drugs, sex, I don't know. They go extreme, and they drop off. It's like the end of the story on the Uncle Meat booklet, where Zappa describes the Dynamo Hum and then says the Jack and the Beanstalk stalks start growing, and the pods on the stalks eventually fall off. I always thought, that was written in 69, I always thought that was a metaphor for people getting involved in the rock industry and then just burning out. They drop off. But, so my basic point is that, now that's back in the 60s, 70s. Now, when you get to the 80s and 90s, where rock is irrelevant under the MTV conditions, you know, it becomes something different, and rock itself is it has an inferior, it has a under siege mentality. It doesn't know how long it's going to last. I mean, you go over the last 30 years, there's been depressions in the rock industry in cycles, right?
Yeah.
And it finally didn't make this one, the one, you know, 8 and 9 years ago.
That's exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so because it got more insecure as a way of offering private identity to kids, it became more rigid and asserted its corporate role. And therefore, the nobody was interested in the preserving the private identity for the consumer that the rock critic represented. You can almost say that by the 90s or 80s and 90s, the kids didn't have the element of music being a private concern. They didn't. Music was not a private concern. What would it have been? It would have been their zine. They started making their own stuff,
I
call producer mania. You have a trend by the late 80s, early 90s, where the young kids aren't into consuming anymore. And that would be another reason why rock criticism died, because the consumer role provided from the 60s to the 80s, providing an image of private concern for the growing private identity-seeking person, that no longer was useful, or the technology bypassed it. And that's partly what I try to point out in my chart in response to your map. But anyways,
we'll get into
it. Yeah, we'll get into it. But just to stay on this point, you're getting what I'm saying, that so if in the 90s you're going to be a rock critic, you're going to be in a dead form with no audience. And the industry, Rolling Stone, is going to make sure you don't cause any questions there. You just keep a dying thing going.
Right.
On the corporate level. Like, the corporate role of rock dies. The private expression, which comes in with the beginning of the digital technology, the computers and that, starts showing up by the middle 80s. By the late 80s and early 90s, the zine thing takes over because people can make their own stuff. So they don't need to follow the corporate role, so it's obsolete to write for Rolling Stone. And that's when Grail Marcus starts going into Lips of Traces and doing another thing, becoming a professor, and when Meltzer, you know, starts writing about something totally different.
Yeah.
They're gone. So does that throw some light on these phases?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and when you say you can't do it today, you could not do a Meltzer or anything, you're talking about it's an Android meme situation that is really weak in terms of the way it was in the 60s, 70s, early 80s.
Right.
Who does it? You don't do it. You start your own website. But who's a Max Tabai? Matt
Taibbi or something?
Yeah, Taibbi. I know him. He wrote for the New York Press. What was interesting is New York Press, I think it is. Burgeoning writers would come to New York in the early 90s, and they would write for New York Press, and you'd watch them try to get to some major magazine. And Matt Taibbi, however you say his name, he's gone.
Yeah.
excuse me, just a second, someone's in the kitchen. Okay, I'm going to move. So the Matt Taibbi, New York Press for many years, and then he became a main guy in the Rolling Stone, but he writes about, well, he wasn't a rock critic, but he...
kind of like a Hunter Thompson, almost, or something.
Yeah, and he... The point is, you're going to be a writer, you don't write about rock. You don't get there. You just be a journalist or something, or...
you don't write exclusively about rock.
Yeah, you do anything. So Matt Taibbi is the one who made that famous article a few months ago on Goldman Sachs for Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
You know, complaining about the Goldman Sachs conspiracy.
Yeah.
And so that's, okay, so how to be a writer. You don't plug yourself into a rock critic. As a matter of fact, there was one rock critic, forget his name, in the New York Press in the 90s, I used to read, and he would spend his time going to as much of a bubblegum music scene that was happening to be hip, to be counter-hip. He hated all the punks or whatever.
Not Chuck Eddy.
No, not Chuck Eddy. This is...
He's often charged with that sort of idea. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, and what's that... Who's that guy who did that book, Puffs and Things? Overland or something?
Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah. He's like Chuck Eddy, or...
A little bit. He's in that vein. They both have books on metal, and they've been compared, yeah.
Yeah, they basically try to find the stupidest, unhip thing and celebrate it, right?
Right. I'd argue that phrasing of it, but sure, go with that for now.
Yeah, no, I mean,
like what Chuck Eddy does, but yeah, go on.
I mean, they were being hyper-individualistic. They'd find some eccentric thing to celebrate, and that actually was the new hip, because his books, what's his name, Ulster book?
Klosterman,
he does well, you know what I mean?
Huge, yeah, he's a huge writer.
But there was this guy at the New York Press who didn't make it that big, but he would, whatever stupid, like the Monkees reunion, I mean, I can't even think of them, Archie's or Archie and the Drells, or somebody would show up in New York City, and he would go and clamor to interview them and celebrate how interesting they were, and it was always interesting to read, you know? I mean, it was interesting. But he would always be knocking... the downtown scene, the village scene. He celebrated the most AM corporate reality that had happened in the 60s and 70s.
Well, that's funny. Chuck Eddy was definitely known for doing that a little bit, too. Within the pages of The Voice, he used to get a lot of letters written to him at The Voice because he would slag Sonic Youth and bands like that. So that was kind of his...
Yeah, all the so-called hip intellectual bands or whatever people... Whatever private concern a college kid thought they had projected into Sonic Youth, he'd make fun of that. So that was... But that's all you could be eccentric. It had nothing to do with anything. Well, no, what did it have to do? I don't know how well that guy... I don't think he got a book contract or anything. And then New York Press got bought out several times, so those guys all got dropped off. I don't know where they are today. I would read them every week. It was interesting to me to read them. But I don't know what a 20-year-old would think reading this guy.
Yeah. Well, the point you made, too, about, not staying within rock exclusively, I mean... It's interesting. Some of the sort of key rock critics from the sort of the late 60s, 70s era. I mean, well, a lot of them just dropped off entirely.
But some of them did what you're saying, like Meltzer went into wrestling and other things.
Yeah, exactly. But then you had someone like Greil Marcus, who, I mean, he's kind of interesting because I'd say in the last 10 years particularly. I mean, I keep tabs on his career. I don't read all his books anymore, but. You know, I think his last three or four books have had actually very little to do with rock and roll, or he's mixed rock and... Actually, that's not entirely true. He's done some stuff about Dylan, but...
Yeah, he did a whole book on Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah, he did a book on Like a Rolling Stone, but he also, like, he's got a book on, like, Clinton, he's got a book on, like, you know, The American Voice or something like that, something about the history of prophets in American history, in American whatever, literature,
right.
Or whatever. So it's like, and he doesn't really seem to participate much in a lot of the critical discussion. He does and he doesn't. He sort of mediates between both. But then you have someone like Chris Gow, who's still totally swimming in it. I mean,
yeah.
Christgau has written about lots of other stuff, for sure, but he's still, you know, he's changed sort of what his consumer guide does. He doesn't write as much about, he acknowledged, like, the glut, I guess, by 10, 15 years ago by saying he was no longer going to consume himself writing about, you know, C-plus records and stuff like that. Now it's all like, you know, Bs are better sort of thing. So it's a bit ridiculous. But, yeah, it's just, I don't know, there's just something interesting about that. I don't know how anyone could completely sustain it for that long, just sticking to the music.
Okay, so, yeah, so... when I read Marcus and these guys, their books, I don't read all of them, but I look at parts of them,
right.
And I'm always a bit peeved because they're good writers. They start pointing out interesting stuff, patterns in public relations or in business and that, but if they'd known my stuff, they could make some goddamn punchlines and conclusions.
Right.
And because they don't, they all end up nowhere. The book becomes interesting, but it's just a little stimulation, you know, candy for the eye, for the mind, and it doesn't lead anywhere. That's why, when I met him, I said, hey, you got to start talking about Finney's Wake. This is what you're really trying to talk about. And he didn't know what I was talking, you know, he didn't know what I meant. He said, oh, that's way over my head. Way over my head, you know, Finney's Wake. They didn't even know. So that's why I find it's titillating to read that, but they're just proving my stuff. I could take all those guys' books and say, okay, here I make this statement. You want to know the background to that? Read Lipstick Traces. But Lipstick Traces doesn't give you the conclusions. I'll give you the conclusions of what, if you want to know something, this is what you'll know, what I say.
But are there conclusions? And...
Yeah.
Why not, you speak about Finnegan's Wake and Joyce in very, if I may say so, like, what's the word, monomaniacal?
No, I just say, like, you can figure out what it is.
Oh, yeah, but Bob, you do, come on, you preach.
Well, that appears, yeah. Well, you mean I repeat
but,
it.
But all I would argue with that, and I'm, is that, like, why isn't it not just one piece of, like, why can't you get something out of Lipstick Traces too that might, maybe, okay, it's not going to tell you the same thing as Finnegan's Wake, maybe, but...
No, it'll give you, you'll get some interesting patterns, like the Situationists and the Sex Pistols and the Dadaists, and they're all interesting movements, populist or upspringing of rebellion, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Now, what's the point... Okay, so you know that. Oh, I didn't know about those guys. Oh, okay, so you run out in the street and you start your little zine and you're going to be a Dadaist or Cabaret Voltaire or something and meet you and then you're arrested within a couple of weeks. And you're arrested not for what you wrote, but because you parked your car in front of the Xerox machine too many times. You know, so you get arrested for that.
Right.
There's so many other factors that come in that the insights... Okay, how do we say this? The insights and inspirations you'll get from Lipstick Traces will dupe you in the long run unless you know what I'm talking about. And most of them all crash.
Is that because they don't understand the ground?
Yeah, they don't understand what the world has become, and they have no way of understanding. It takes a while to get it, and you have to be prepared, and they don't get it in their educational system or in their Grail Marcus books. Grail Marcus does not tell why those scenes came and went, and what happened to those people, and how you would not do it today if you wanted to create that effect, and whether you could even create that effect. So it's basic romanticism. It's just sentimentalizing what people did when they were human beings.
But I've heard Ben Watson argue.
Oh, he doesn't agree with me on that. He still thinks.
Yeah, I've heard him argue that because he said, Bob, you put it all. He calls it technological determinism.
Yeah.
He says
yeah.
you and your McLuhanist technological determinism, and he says, you know, you're not. There's always people behind it and all that sort of thing. And I mean, I don't know. I listened to that argument. I don't know where, you know. Where
okay. No. That. Okay. Look. There's people. There's room for people. Have you seen anybody pulling it off yet, proving there are people, other than in temporary things that lead nowhere? Every one of those indie movies the last 15 years is about the malaise of being a young person, and you do something in the plot of the movie, and it leads nowhere. leads to cynicism. They don't know how to get through this. And I'm not saying that you become a Christian or something or a Muslim. There's other ways to, in a humanist way, see what's going on, and you might come up with a more original response. So Ben, he's coming around a bit. You know, you heard the latest show. He's starting to, he sent me an email saying, I really am gratified that you've made me more aware of the electric ether. That's what he said. I forwarded it to you. You saw it, right?
Yeah. I haven't heard the show that it referenced yet, though. So.
Right. No, it was very polarized in a pleasant way at the beginning. It's not so. He's beginning to see a bit of what I'm saying. And I'm actually saying, okay, now we know what I'm saying, Ben. Now I'm willing to be the person you're looking for to activate behind the scenes or be the people. Now we start a revolution. And he has that on the latest blurb for number 27 or 28, whichever one it is. He says, we finally come to agree that Finnegan's Wake is the masterpiece for our revolution. We now start the revolution.
28 conversations.
Yeah. We finally got on the same page. So, okay, so where are we going to run off to? You know, where are we going to do it? So, to hear what. Well, if you're listening to us now, if you want to hear the subset of what Scott and I are saying, you go through the 28 shows of Bob and Ben, you know, that's on Resonance FM.
Course, yeah, I want to get to those, actually.
Oh, yeah, okay, good. So, okay, technological determinism. There is so much freedom. See, the images of freedom that Lipsy Traces celebrates, of
right.
temporary autonomous zones or whatever, everybody's got that automatically. Your suburban housewife's got that. Your single mother. Everybody's got expressive freedom now in those ways. What do you demand to be corrected, other than if you were Ben Watson who says we get rid of money? You know, and money has been gotten rid of. Here's another thing. You're going to have to define what your problem is better than just saying, okay, let's get rid of money. Well, they got rid of money. Now what? Okay, let's get rid of credit cards. Oh, okay, now you're getting somewhere. But the
but if everyone has those freedoms, not everyone knows how to express something about them, though.
That's the issue. I'm telling people how to express themselves, or what is hindering their expression.
But why isn't Lipstick Traces doing that? Like, or why? Like, I'm not convinced that it's not doing that. Is what I mean to say.
Okay. What inspiration did you get from Lipstick Traces? Solution.
Well, okay. No, there's. I would say right. There's no. There's no solution, but I mean
it was an enjoyable read. Okay, it's a good read. Well, there's
it's funny because actually Ben says that exact phrase about Lipstick Traces in his foreword or his introduction to his Frank Zappa book, which I thought was, I think I even underlined it. I was like, oh man, what a backhanded kind of compliment. Like he just calls it a good read, sort of thing.
Yeah,
but. I think there's more to it than that. I mean, yes, it's a good read, but it's something that, you know, it gives you a way of seeing things that will stick with you.
Well, did it stick with you?
Well,
can you say what it is?
Well, I mean, just sort of seeing, it is pattern recognition, probably, is what I would ultimately say.
Pattern recognition is what we all do. It's significant pattern recognition I'm offering. And I'm saying that that doesn't offer any comprehensive significant pattern recognition. It does offer pattern recognition. That's no big deal. You can get pattern recognition anywhere. A conversation like ours gives pattern recognition. But what's comprehensive pattern recognition or something will do with it? You can't tell me what you've learned or applied from that Lipstick Traces.
Well, I'm having a hard time right now, this second sort of...
To remember.
Formulating it into, like, one coherent sentence, because I think it's a multi-level book. I mean, I'd be really weary without sort of thinking about it and looking through it again to try and, you know, say a pithy sort of two-sentence...
Well, it doesn't have to be...
But I don't really read it necessarily... I mean, I read to learn, but I don't.
Yeah, to have a good read.
But I don't read for a solution necessarily. Why must
you? No, you read it to
a solution.
You read it to massage yourself. It's a good read.
But does McLuhan give me a solution? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
He's telling you what's going on and all that. But
yeah, but in a deeper way, so that. In a way, if you understood McLuhan, you wouldn't have to read all these different things or watch shows to find out what's going on, because you know that they would never get to the point that they should get to, which is stated by McLuhan. The answer to everything in the last 40 years about why everything happened, why it is, why all the different interpretations of what's happened, is the medium is the massage. That's what did it. And McLuhan found the key to social change. And anything, why did the sexual revolution happen? Why did it fade out? Why did it come back? Why did AIDS happen? Why are kids indifferent to it? Why are people now, 12-year-olds, filming themselves and putting up in their high school bulletin boards, you know, having blowjobs?
Is it not fair to say, though, that McLuhan may have been the one who you know, found a language to express that, and he, you know, was the most conscious of it happening, and he, you know, he's the only one who kind of put it into those specific types of terms. But
there were
other, like, great intellects from the period who also, McLuhan and Norman Mailer.
No, listen.
Did Norman Mailer not say anything of value?
He didn't. Those intellects never come up with anything to figure out. They remain puzzled and confused. Norm Mailer, you know, I've tracked him. I knew him. So he moves through and he says these different things at different phases, and he's always like saying, yeah, maybe McLuhan's right. And he never could handle it after. To the point he said, yeah, maybe my greatest novel dream was obsolete. I shouldn't have done that. And he didn't know what McLuhan said, that the great American novel was the newspaper. So in his struggle, he kept writing great books. Nothing wrong with his books, but people, if you're just interested in having a good read, then that's okay. It's a drug for you. But don't start complaining to me that life is meaningless or something. Don't deny that you're just a robot, a bad robot for electronic stimulation. And don't complain about George Bush, Rush Limbaugh, or anybody else, or Ayatollah Khomeini, or Mao Zedong, in such silly terms that don't acknowledge that you're just like them, a whore like all the rest. Now, even that title is not the best way to say it.
Why? Why?
Because you're referring to the chemical body. And you can explain why Meltzer had to become, quote, a whore. Like everybody has to. That's a private individual's response to the corporate role you must take. I mean, take McLuhan's explanation for the twist. You can look at a CBC interview with Robert Fulford about 1962, and that's right when John Glenn's going up from Cape Canaveral, they called it. And
right.
And they're talking about the twist, and they show some footage, and Robert Fulford says, what's this mean? Because the twist was shocking, you know, because so many, all ages were jumping in and doing it, from Jackie Kennedy to your local junkie. So what's happening here, Marshall? He says, well, I call it Cape Canaveral Caper. So he immediately refers it, cross-indexes across to what's going on in space, where people are beginning, through the image of the astronaut, to leave the planet and rotate around the global matrix. Okay, so how do you do that in daily life? He says these people, the average citizen who does the twist, they have very tight, controlled, disciplined corporate roles, corporate jobs. You would say not really a job, a role. They need to unwind. It's a kind of unraveling at the end of the day. So, and he says it's not, it's a conversation, and the gestures of the hands and twisting is a conversation. So you have this unraveling conversation, unwinding, and express yourself again, your private chemical body. That is a good beginning at looking at what the twist is. He's not talking about Chubby Checker or who's the best twist musician, how long would it last. He's saying exactly why, right now, the twist is a way for people to unwind, because you're starting to go into the 60s, a more tribal corporate role-playing society dictated by the information computerized environment, and so the twist shows up.
So a lot of critics, there are some critics who have written about the twist in, it seems like a fairly intelligent or coherent way, and not just talking about, you know, Chubby Checker and all that stuff, but some, you know, I've read some critics sort of go into, well, you know, what, you know, the twist kind of, like, the impact it sort of had on dancing and stuff, and how it, yeah, I think sort of like it brought, like, dancing to the private sort of realm, like it was no longer holding your
partner. It made everybody an astronaut. That's what McLuhan said. In the twist, it's different, he says. You create your own space.
Okay, so my question being then is sort of what you're saying would be the difference then between, you know, what I'm describing as one type of perceptive critic and McLuhan, who you know would say is obviously, you know, more perceptive than all of them, is that some of the critics I may have read and like over the years. They can point out, like, the what, but they have no clue as to the why.
Yeah. The why.
Like they can sort of, you know, put it into language that well. That, like, most people, let's be honest, they'll look at a phenomenon like the twist, and they'll just say, well, it's a new dance craze.
Yeah, yeah.
Check the new record, and, you know, they move. And then you'll have another kind of strata of society, you know, the quote-unquote rock critics, who will say, well, you know, let's look at how dancing has evolved over the years, and it's no longer, you know, holding your partner, and it's asserting your private identity, and that kind of leads into the Beatles and all that, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But if McLuhan takes it to a different level entirely, was like, well, this is kind of why it's happening, kids, because of
NASA. See, McLuhan shows the same pattern goes across the board in different areas of human expression. So he's really...
Right.
The twist is the first time people start dancing and ignoring their partner, basically.
Right.
A little bit, you know, it gets even more decentralized later. But here it is, they're not really matching with their partner, they're creating their own space. And Marshall says that's Cape Canaveral Caper. The astronaut is a way of creating your own space off the planet. And so Marshall is saying the twist is doing your thing, and doing your thing comes up as a phrase 5 years later as maybe an antidote to whatever Chubby Checker represented, corporate AM radio. And so those saying do your own thing don't know that they're just mass marketing the satellite effect, which the twist was the first expression of. Now that's an interesting pattern. It starts you, gets you looking across the board, and you say, well, how come it's happening there and there and there? Well, what's the common denominator? Oh, it's the computer. It's television. You realize, oh, the mass medium does affect everybody in all fields, and you can look at the characteristics of the mass medium and see, oh, yeah, that's how it's expressed in different, from art. Pop art is another form of doing the twist. You know, Andy Warhol. He did a twist with the factory. That is what Joyce is doing in Finney's Wake. He takes a theme, and then he shows and all these other things that resonate through the word and the pun, resonate with that theme, and shows an x-ray of the moment he's showing, of the period, of the era. Now, that's a way of getting perspective on where you are. Now, maybe that's impossible for people to do, you know. The average mind just doesn't want to think, quote, big. But they always, in their own lives, bump into something, a problem in their life, and if they knew what McLuhan was talking about, they could apply it to their life and have a better perspective on it.
Okay, so McLuhan, in that sense, and Bob Dobbs as well, can... I think you've mentioned this before in other interviews, where you can basically talk about anything, because you don't need to...
Yeah.
You don't need to necessarily delve into all... Now, I want to have this conversation at some point, too, where I still think there is some... You do need to delve into specifics when you're talking about certain things to have a certain type of understanding of it.
Right.
But you.
Well, that's what we're doing in this series. We're looking at rock criticism.
That's true. So, but you would say that you can delve... You can have an understanding of, like, I don't know, anything? Just by, if you know sort of how it works and, you know, what the basic sort of premise of something is, you can apply...
It's a formula. I can apply it to anything that's going on. Up till a little while ago, and then I had to dump McLuhan and create my own new formula because McLuhan was obsolete. But he was the best formula for that period, the analog media phase.
And what was the breach there? The digital?
The digital is where the technology is not massaging people. It's massaging its own extensions. The Android meme is when technology takes on a life of its own and extends itself. And it's only talking back and forth among itself. It's not talking to people anymore. People can identify with different interpretations of what they think is going on, but they are they're sidelined by the late 70s.
So how can someone, because I'm having difficulty doing it, obviously, how can someone visualize that? Like, when you say the Android...
Technology talking
to itself, like...
How do you visualize it to people?
How do you explain that?
Here's how you visualize it. McLuhan's answer was, take an inventory of what's happening to society across the board. So you look at 1982. What's happening? You got an actor as a president. You've got a collapsed economy. You've got the space shuttles happening. Mick Jagger has brought the Stones out of mothballs. There's the Falklands War. You just... start look what's happening in the art. German neo-expressionism, I think, took over in the early 80s. So you look across the board and make an inventory and see what the common denominator is. That's what my chart, Connie Note chart, is. It's an inventory of 1960 to 1990. It lists all kinds of activities and tries to show a nest egg on one level, and then a bigger nest egg, and then a bigger envelope. The final envelope, the bigger one, is homeopathic satellite radio, those phrases. But I try to show across each horizontal quadrant what's going on at the time. And you kind of try to figure out what the pattern is. That's what you do. There's no point in becoming an expert in grape juice or restoration comedy or the Rolling Stones budget, Rolling Stone magazine's budget for the 80s and 90s. Any particular specialist topic is not going to get you anywhere. You can spend a lot of time creating something from it and put out a book and maybe get paid for it.
Yeah.
But it does not provide an antidote to the situation where specialist cures do not solve specialist ills. Lipstick traces is a specialist cure for the specialist ill of being a chemical body or an art student who's trying to figure out where to go with art. Or whatever they, who knows how you use lipstick traces. You can't even say it that way. Whatever they're doing in college to figure out what's their stance for how they're going to make a living.
Okay.
They'll read lipstick traces to get an answer, and that'll just be a specialist answer for a specialist cure. That book is a specialism. It specializes in an inventory of radical movements. And by the 80s, the radical movement is the Android meme. There's not a human dimension to it. And the subtleness of the Android meme is it makes you think you are in charge. That's the subtle seduction of the Android meme. It makes itself more and more invisible. And said, and now we come to the point where, you know, 8 years ago, whenever, people started to have their own MySpaces.
Right.
The Android meme gave them everything. Way beyond writing a zine. I mean, your rockcritics.com is an example.
Yeah.
You got to create your own space.
Yeah.
Didn't make any money from it, right?
No.
Now, that's hard. It's hard to make money today in anything, say, starting in the 90s. Because money was really an obsolete medium.
Okay.
So, you know, the thing is it depends. I found that when you explain McLuhan to a smart person, a reasonably a curious and interesting person, and you really talk about what he's talking about and you make it understandable, the person's eyes are expanded. They say, wow, that is something to remember. It's a pattern, you know?
It's amazing how many people still, like, so badly sort of misinterpret stuff. And Meltzer is an example.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, it's terrible. And, you know, when I interviewed him and I asked him about them, in retrospect, obviously, I wish I had kind of pushed him. And because I kind of knew when he gave a really stock response, oh, that's kind of ridiculous. But, you know, I just wasn't up for that sort of challenge.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
like that kind of an interview. It's like, look, I'm interviewing kind of one of my heroes here, and that, you know, I just want to know what you think of the guy, sort of thing.
Right.
You know? But I did kind of know. It's like, that sounded really simplistic what he said. It's
yeah,
like,
he's talking about Burroughs. He's talking about McLuhan's review of Burroughs's Naked Lunch, and
right.
I think he clues that McLuhan is pro junk.
it's a bizarre interpretation, because actually I did just go and find that Nation piece, and I don't know how he got that at all. That seems
I want to go through that, because that is a fantastic synopsis of McLuhanism, that review of Burroughs, and he purposely says what he says to be an anti-environment to Burroughs and even to Joyce. It's a really key statement. And we, at some point, we'll get out the quote from Meltzer, what he said to you, and then go from there. And I'll give you some more significant patterns about it.
Exactly. Okay.
So you started, I think you said in there, you're not sure how it can help you.
I said that, I probably haven't, taken any specific quote-unquote lesson from a book like Lipstick Traces, but
I'm saying that good movies.
Is that the purpose of art, or is that the purpose of? I mean,
art. Art content.
Like
art content is a drug. No, there's nothing wrong with a drug, but it's a drug. If you want to see through the pharmaceutical level of media consumption you're in, that's you got to do it through McLuhan and Finney's Wake. That's the only way you're going to see through it. Otherwise, You're just another person loving your movies and music and consuming all this stuff and complaining about how someone else is making a lot of money out of it, and you aren't. And you might find a way to publish your opinions, but it doesn't make you any money, and you're left alienated. And there's a way to see through that. And it might even diminish your consumption. I mean, probably you go to a 15-year-old, you know, YouTube or blog, and they'll say they like some band that I've never heard of that just showed up, and they'll say, you know, this band's really good. They put down the government. They don't want to sell stuff,
right.
Which is what was said by the Beatniks, you know,
right.
And their fans. They're going through, they're like little amoeba going through the phases of my chart. They've arrived at the LaRouche quadrant and are complaining about teachers from schools and authority or God. You know what I mean? They've just begun. And from my perspective, they'll never get through the phases of the chart, which are God, sex, politics, consciousness, Orphic Baroque spirals. Those are the five quadrants of my chart, which are the different main foundations of the Android meme. So, obviously my stuff is postgraduate, but I'm still here, ready to talk to the 15-year-olds. They want to get sparked, but if I go and speak into, and I've done it a little bit, talk to a few high school classes, a couple of kids come up and say, wow, that was amazing. What should we do about this? They might get a very negative, they think it's apocalyptic, or they just they didn't understand how.
Like when I first interviewed.
Yeah, you get depressed, you get suicidal. And I said, no, don't do anything about that. What you thought you heard, you didn't hear. I would just recommend you keep reading this stuff a little bit more when you get a chance. There's no hurry. Don't worry. But they're, in a sense, a state of urgency. You know, no, I got to know now. I got to go to college next week. I got to figure out what I'm going to major in. Or I got to get a job, you know. And it's all this worry, and that's natural. So, so you speak to these kids, and I think, well, they've got to go through so many phases to get to, and they have to want it, to get to a level that I'm talking about. So I don't care how they interpret what I say. Whatever they get, if they don't like it, good. Doesn't matter. There's no audience for it. But there is an audience for someone like you who gets in touch with me, and then we want to go into it.
Yeah. Okay, let me go into another... One more thing that you said in the last conversation that I've kind of been thinking about and not really understanding is you had a little sideline thing about Meltzer quoting Surfing Bird. And what you said, I actually did write this quote down, what is it? You said in that the bird is the word, quote-unquote, expresses what's going on in the most profound levels of power in a mediated society in a global theater in the 60s. It doesn't matter what word it is.
Right.
I don't get that.
Yes, it's a big, these are big landscapes, you know what I mean? And, someone once told me, you know, Bob, I never was very good at thinking big. And I said, well, what the heck? Thinking big, I was thinking, okay, why wouldn't you be able to think big? And I thought, well, the person has an inferiority complex and doesn't imagine themselves, you know, being equal to the universe or something. But if you did imagine yourself being that, then you would be thinking, quote, big. So it's not really thinking big, it's just knowing where you are and what you can take on.
That's so funny, because I think most rock critics would hear these conversations and think, yeah, I don't want anything to do with this. What are you guys like talking about? This is ridiculous. And I think you've just pinpointed part of the reason why many of them would feel that way. But go on.
Yeah, because they got inferiority complexes.
Yeah.
They misidentify what thinking big is. Okay, so the statement. Oh yeah. So McLuhan in 1974 wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. It was called A Media Approach to Inflation. Here it was, big inflation problem, started coming up in 73, 74, and everybody's wondering, what the hell are we going to do about it? And we even got stagflation. McLuhan immediately had a brilliant article. It's like an article every person, before they can vote, they got to read that article and understand it. But he lays out what's going on in figure ground terms, thinking big, and explaining all, and it's prophetic. As a matter of fact, remember I read some of it to Ben and Michael Turser? Or
yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
And they really overreacted to certain lines in it. They didn't like it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And misinterpreted. But anyways, He points out in that article that we're in a situation where the word makes the market. And the word, W of words capitalized, M of makes capitalized, and market is capitalized. Maybe even the T of the. The word makes the market. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you've so imploded, that means there's only one microphone, and that whoever has that microphone determines what is real, what isn't. Whether UFOs have landed, whether cancer can be cured, whether unions are relevant, all the things. One microphone, because all the media, this is at the end of the analog media phase, before you get to digital media. And so everybody is focused on what? The White House. And all media is geared about who's president, who was president, who's going to be president. So the White House was the word that made the market. It determined where we were. Are we going to go bomb Vietnam? Are we going to bomb Israel? Are we going to bomb Saudi Arabia? Are we going to raise interest rates? It was all geared. And that's why you got packed journalism around that time. They're all going to the White House or to anything that's coming out of the White House to find out what's what. Okay, so the word makes the market. McClellan says that. It's obvious in 74, 75. But it actually was the fact, partly in the radio era, but more so in the TV era, and then especially in the 60s. So in 1962 or 3, when that song, The Bird is the Word, comes out,
right.
For me, to just say the word, you're on the right track. And to say something absurd like the bird is to point out that the word that makes the market is an ongoing phenomenon from the White House that has no point of view, does not stop at any point, does not make a decision, doesn't say whether it's cancer cure or not. It's what you call a phatic situation, phatic, where it's just keeping the conversation going. You're not to get up too upset about the content and whether a point's being made. That's why
the pat on the back, I think you described it once or something.
Well, when you're at a job and you see someone, you go, "How you doing?" And they say back, "How you doing?" You don't tell them how you doing. It's just it's a wave. Yeah, a pat on the back, a acknowledgement. It's a gesture of amiability, social cohesion. So that is the function of the White House. And just to keep saying, so the bird is a word. There's many levels you can look at this. One level is the bird is something in nature. The word that makes the market, the electronic imploded communication that the White House is responding to, is a form of nature. So the word is a bird. It's nature. As people think, well, I gotta deal with nature. I gotta make a living within my chemical body, nature. Well, the bird is a word. The word language is important for your job, for whether you're going to have a job or not. Because are they going to overcome the oil shortage crisis in 74? What are they going to say about that? So the bird is a word. Also expresses the phatic level, the ongoing. We never really get to a point, but the White House keeps having press conferences and keeps telling us what they're doing. He's still insisting it's the White House. That's an ongoing phatic process. All right? It's just, okay. Yeah, there's still a public space out there. There's still a country and there's still a White House. So it's serving as a phatic level, at the phatic level. And that's another meaning of the bird as a word. It's a phatic, it's what they call a nonsense phrase. It doesn't have any real semantic meaning. Well, that's like pointing out the phatic nature of communication.
Right, okay.
So that's a beginning way. And then you could say, because people can't see that situation, they're not perceptive enough, they're not trained in media analysis like McLuhan developed for years, they will just see themselves in the content. And the word is, McLuhan did an essay, commented on an essay in the late 60s called The Word of the Year. And every year there were, over the last, say, 50s and 60s, there was a word that was the buzzword of that 12-month period. And it went through all the buzzwords. So you have the word of the year. So the bird is a word. So rock and roll says this, whatever, what would be the buzzword in 62, 63? Cuban Missile Crisis, Castro, whatever that was, you know? Okay. Something about that. Fallout shelters. The rock comes on and makes fun of that and says, no, this absurd little thing is the word, not serious stuff. So there's the sort of childish, mocking level of rock, and that provides a detachment, a sense of private identity for the consumer of that song, for the young kid.
So based on
so I think it's great that it begins with that, because that he repeats that line all over the whole song at the beginning of the book, A Study of Rock.
Yeah.
That is what he's trying to explain. I don't know if he knows it, but I'm trying to explain why it's so appropriate to begin with that.
That's what I was exactly what I was going to ask. I was going to say, based on what you're familiar with of his book, like the chapter. I know you said you read some of it a long time ago as well, but based on the current stuff I've sent you, do you think he's putting it in consciously for something at least, sort of anticipating that? Like, I know you would say he doesn't have the full McLuhanite Joyce kind of understanding of it, but do you think? Would you almost get? I mean, who cares in a way what his intention was?
No, it's important. Somebody who heard our first couple dialogues and really liked the second one said, "Man, you were really impressed with Meltzer. You couldn't believe it. You were left speechless at some points during the last session we did about this." And I didn't get into an argument. I told him, no, that's not what's happening. I'm saying that here are the words to express what I mean. It's not celebrating Meltzer's mind, though it is unique that he created that. And I'm pointing out the things he's describing is an effect. He's inside an effect. He's on a drug. And his word, the way he expresses it, is the closest to pointing out what the drug is he's on. So I was trying to point out what Meltzer was on by using his statements. And he was the best way to show the drug everybody was on in the 60s, if they understood it, the speed of light imploded society they were living in, and the role of rock as an anti-environment or temporary panacea or drug or anesthetic for people. And so Meltzer, he got stoned, he did his stone probably. That's a good way to begin to try to tune into the present. And so he, quote, channeled half of it or just hallucinated. He didn't know. I don't know what he knew, what he meant. But what he produced are very useful scientific, quote, scientific data for me to explain what drug he took. I'm not celebrating the drug he's on. I'm explaining what the drug he's on and what it did.
Okay.
So that's, it doesn't go into appreciating, I don't know what you call it. I mean, look at Dylan. He says that he doesn't know why he wrote those songs. You know, the recent, that big special on him a couple of years ago that Martin Scorsese did, they ask him, what do you think of those songs, you know, and Blonde and Blonde, Like a Rolling Stone, and all that stuff. He says, I don't know how they happen. You know, I don't know what I was talking about. I don't know what they're about, and they can't be done again. He doesn't know that he was responding as a young mind to the environment around him.
Right.
It's certainly nobody else did it, so he's unique and you can call that genius. And he makes great music out of that. And that's all it is, great music. But if you want to find out what deeper levels of the pattern recognition, you go to what I'm talking about, what the level is. Like, and you know what, did I tell you this, what Dylan said in 1985 in a Spin interview?
No.
He said, I just happened to see it and looked at it, and he said, if you want to know what happened in the 60s, read Norman Mailer and Marsha McLuhan. And that's the most incredible statement I've ever heard from anybody in the rock world. I mean, that implies he knew. Well, he knew by 1985 that if you want to know what was going on. But what's interesting, he doesn't bring that up now. You know, say that now when Martin Scorsese is talking to you, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I don't know if they know.
Huh. So not to be pedantic about it, but he, going back to what I said earlier, but he says McLuhan and Mailer.
Yeah.
What I'm still having a bit of a hard time grappling with, just in general, although I'm sort of getting it, sort of, but is the idea of McLuhan, well, you would say McLuhan, Joyce, Dobbs, probably, as kind of only. You use the word only sometimes when you talk about McLuhan. He's the only guy who got it. But I'm still having a hard time.
He's not the only...
Mailer did not contribute anything.
Oh, Mailer contributed, but Mailer was... have you seen any of the dialogues between Mailer and McLuhan that CBC did?
Yeah. And I know that Mailer has, like, in many occasions or some occasions, deferred to McLuhan. And
yeah.
I think I saw him quoted somewhere saying he'd never met a mind...
who went that fast. He said, I thought I was the fastest gun in the West, but when I met McLuhan, oh, no, he's way faster than me.
Right. But he's still fast, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. No, he's fast. No, there's a lot of talented people. But as McLuhan understood by the 50s, talent was obsolete. you're just going to be chewed up and spit out. And he was the only one who could survive all that. He didn't identify with any successful or labels of talent put on him. He didn't believe in that. He knew it was not relevant. There was a, in this 1985, here's Spin Magazine. Well, Bob Marshall and Nelson Thal took some ideas and made a chart, and it was shown up on one of the Bosmian Ecology albums, the top-down identity chart and the bottom-up identity. In it, they had, for the black-and-white TV period, Norma Mailer. For the color TV, later 60s and psychedelic period, Marsh McLuhan. Marsh McLuhan is the artist for the later phase and Mailer for the earlier phase. The thing is, that came out on April 22nd, 85. I'm not sure when that interview in Spin Magazine, in my mind it might have been a March issue. I'm not sure, March 85. But what's incredible, that pattern of Mailer and McLuhan for the 60s comes out the same time people are reading Dylan saying that. And that's another example of my own personal musical's anachrony with the Android meme. So that's a side thing. But what he meant, I don't know what he meant, but I would say that Norman Mailer did the top-down concerns,
right,
and McLuhan did the bottom-up concerns.
Right.
And they go together. It's complementary. So it's appropriate, because it's not you only read McLuhan. You got to read other people like LaRouche. For the top-down, you balance it off. But in the end, the useful thing is more McLuhan, the bottom-up for the bigger pattern. So Dylan was right to say Mailer and McLuhan, not just say McLuhan.
Right, okay.
Now, you know, if people hear what I'm saying, this, they don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But if you took the time to figure it out, this is not nutty talk. This is technical, scientific, quote, scientific talk based on what you can know if you've done your homework.
Yeah. Well, certainly I hope some people who, have been interested in Meltzer, for instance, for years. Certainly, I hope they're going to hear some of that, your readings of that stuff last week, because I personally just don't see how any of that can be refuted. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
You laid out certain sort of pattern that he's, and the whole thing of writing from the tactile sort of, well, not a perspective, but whatever. It's
yeah.
a very tactile experience.
That's the main assumption.
And
if you accept the assumption of tactility, then it'll make sense. If you don't accept it, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But, you're right. Even if he didn't agree with me, it's the closest you can say. What I said is the closest and normal way of interpreting what the phenomenon is. It makes sense what I say.
I would love to get some of your comments to Meltzer, actually. I mean, we've discussed that briefly before, and I don't know, he may have shut the world down too much.
Well, that's
I don't know. I don't want to make that assumption, but I'd be really curious. I mean, he's obviously is a smart guy, and maybe he'll hear it and think, hey, this guy.
Yeah, he may be interested enough to say, well, what do you mean?
Yeah, no, exactly.
No, that's good. Now we come to, I think, 1 o'clock your time.
Yeah, I think we're at that point. I mean, it seems like it was a bit of a shorter conversation, and I've even got, more questions. But let's cut this one off now. And
it was good. It was a different timbre, different
exactly,
mood.
Exactly. So we'll definitely, I would say fairly soon. I mean, I know we've been on the Meltzer a long time. I really want to go into the Meltzer Zappa sort of sideline thing. I think that will be really interesting. That is the one thing I've kind of been thinking about a lot in the last couple weeks or week or so. So maybe we'll even consider starting off with that.
Yeah,
and I have some stuff to send you along those lines. I just didn't have time this week. So I have a couple more things I can send you with some references and that sort of thing. So that'll help out.
Right, and then we'll look at what Earmap said, the five phases, the critics, that, and then I say, well, where does Zappa fit in this mix? Then we have a way of looking at that, and then we compare Meltzer to that, That would be good. Okay, great. Thanks.
Why don't we do that? That's awesome, Bob.
All right. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thanks again. We'll talk
okay.
next time. Bye-bye.